unless there is a rethinking, one, of debt sustainability, two, trade strategy, three, how we preserve macroeconomic and financial stability and growth, we are not going to make it in this world.
Mia Motley, the Prime Minister of Barbados, has been a champion for change when it comes to helping island states and low-income countries recover from health shocks and climate shocks for which they had very little hand in creating. In this program, we'll hear Mia Motley and other leaders talk about a new financing tool to help countries adapt to the new world. It's called the Resilience and Sustainability Trust, or RST, developed by the IMF under the leadership of its managing director, Kristalina Georgieva.
The big innovation of the RST actually came with the recognition that when we provided $650 billion SDR allocations to all our members, a significant part went to countries in strong position that actually didn't need it. So what did they do? They put it at the bottom of their reserves and it became a sleeping beauty. And then we thought, why not? A kiss that wakes it up. And that is what we actually did. It's a very simple thing, saying in a world where needs are so gigantic and resources are constrained, we should not allow a dormant asset if we can make something out of it. And that idea got a pickup by many leaders, and I'm extremely grateful to them. And it led to a commitment of 20% of SDRs of countries in strong positions, strong reserves, to be directed through the IMF through two vehicles, the Poverty Reduction and Growth Trust and the newly created Resilience and Sustainability Trust.
Now, the enthusiasm for making the RSD operational was quickly evident from both creditor and borrower countries. We immediately got pledges for 30 billion SDRs from 17 countries, and right now we are at 15.5 billion signed agreements, with more to come in 2023. On the borrowing side, we already have four countries that have signed staff-level agreements and three approvals, including Barbados and Rwanda. Congratulations. Costa Rica is the other one. Bangladesh is in the pipeline. And we also have a very large pipeline of countries that we are engaging, and we are at various stages of discussion. The RSD is the fruit of a shared vision, responsibility, and commitment of the international community to help low and vulnerable middle-income countries overcome global policy challenges and enhance resilience. It is a testament to what can be achieved when there is a massive collaboration effort across our shareholders, internal and external stakeholders, and our partners among the international financial institutions. Now, success of the trust depends equally on meaningful contributions to the trust from our members, strong ownership and commitment of the borrowing authorities to implement the reforms, and our collaboration with the IFIs to be able to leverage each other's expertise to come up with the right reforms. And such a collective effort will be critical to mobilize large financing from the private sector. Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Uma Ramakrishna, one of the chief architects of the Resilience and Sustainability Trust. She's also deputy director in the IMF's Strategy, Policy and Review Department. The conversation we are about to hear includes Prime Minister Mia Motley of Barbados, who we heard earlier, Rwanda's President Paul Kagame, the Director General of the World Trade Organization Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, and Maktar Diop, Managing Director of the IFC, or the International Finance Corporation. The discussion is moderated by Rajiv Shah, President of the Rockefeller Foundation.
So I'm going to start us off, Kristalina, with you. You reached out a while back to say, let's make this happen. Why is this instrument so important for your future, for the institution's ability to move the needle on climate? And is this an example of what you mean when you say we need all hands on deck to address the climate crisis?
Oh, thank you very much, Rash. I want to thank everybody here in the audience, our board members. They made that possible. Many of them are contributors to the RST. Our staff, the staff of the IMF, these are fabulous people. They make the impossible possible. Our partners from the World Bank, from other institutions, and above all, our members. Together, we have turned what was a dream just a year ago into a reality. Why is this so important for the IMF? Because our institution has a very clear mandate: macroeconomic and financial stability, growth and employment. Climate change, climate shocks undermine macroeconomic stability, undermine our ability to support countries to grow and improve the livelihoods of people. So for our institution to be effective in a world where climate change is already present in economies and in the lives of people, to come up with reforming the way we work, creating new instruments that are suitable to support long-term transformation is absolutely paramount. I want to stress three things that this trust represents. Number one, for the first time, the international community, through the Resilience and Sustainability Trust, recognizes vulnerability as a criteria from concessional finance. We have gone a long way to be good stewards for the world's poor people by providing concessional finance to low-income countries. But with this trust, we recognize that Barbados may not be a low-income country, but it is highly vulnerable to exogenous shocks, to a crisis Barbados did very little to create. And therefore, concessionality is a fair way of the international community supporting countries like Barbados. Number two, the IMF is very strong in providing support for policy reforms. So when we work with countries and we talk about fiscal sustainability, a sound monetary policy, we integrate climate, so it is part of that soundness of policy reforms. And number three, because we can leverage finance with other institutions and most importantly, with the private sector. Here is our reality. Unless we change the trajectory of carbon emissions in emerging markets and developing economies, now, by 2030, they would contribute 66% of the emissions, 20% more than they did some decade ago. So for all of us, and that goes to all hands on deck, for all of us, it is so critical that we help emerging markets and developing countries to transform to low carbon and climate resilient trajectory, or otherwise we are all cooked.
That's both one way to say it and also absolutely true. So we appreciate your leadership, Kristalina. Both Rwanda and Barbados have received preliminary approvals of programs under the RST. And perhaps, Prime Minister Motley, I could come to you next to describe how will this program in Barbados work towards the vision that Kristalina just laid out of reducing emissions and protecting against vulnerability. And frankly, you have been such an extraordinary global voice for reshaping the financial architecture to deal with climate head on through the Bridgetown Initiative. How is this related to your vision of a more just global financial system?
Well, thank you very much, Raj. And I want to start this morning by congratulating Kristalina and Uma and all of the staff at the IMF for being brave enough to think outside the box. And I really, really want to commend all of you for allowing us to be here. and to change the assumptions that guided the functioning of this institution, and hope that this will now trigger others to have the confidence to do the same. For us, we are not in the business of just a single issue that can define us. And therefore, how we treat to development and climate resilience is part of the same conversation. And we've been saying for some time now that we need long-term capital in order to address many of the issues. If not, we will just be crowded out. This is not a new concept. Britain understood it needed long-term capital when it was financing World War I. Germany understood it needed long-term capital after its defeat in World War II. Small countries and middle-income vulnerable countries need it if we're not going to be pauperized. And these institutions were set up, yes, to fight poverty, not promote poverty. So that the ability now to be able to deal with the vulnerability is critical if we're going to have the growth, the macroeconomic and financial stability that you spoke about, and the jobs above all else that make life worthwhile for average citizens. We suffer, for example, from not just the hurricanes, but we suffer from a groundwater crisis. And the ability to replace our water mains is in and of itself a 20 to 25 year exercise alone. So that you need to be able to have access to capital that will at least not cause you to have difficulty while maintaining your other obligations for development. 20-year capital starts it. We would like to see quotas removed because we feel that that's the one constraint, but we understand that this is a significant movement of the needle, and we will keep the pressure on for the quotas to be removed. But we also understand that that is a function of the response of the rest of the developed world being able to put more into the pot so that more people can benefit. So we look forward to this being able to help us with coastal defense, water mains, a number of other early warning systems, and above all else, the repurposing and reconstruction of our housing stock. If we get hit tomorrow, my greatest fear is that we will lose about 70% of our low and lower middle income housing stock because of the manner in which roofs were constructed for the last 60 years. And that's part of parcel of why we call it a roofs to reefs project, because we have to change from our roofs right back down to the rebuilding of our coral reefs.
And can I push you on one comment? As part of your Bridgetown vision, you've also talked about extending the time horizon on debt sustainability.
Oh, absolutely.
I think about that. Can you say a quick, short comment about how important that is and why?
And the IMF has done its part. We now need the other institutions to extend their timelines for development capital. Look, we cannot pursue education, health, all of the other SDGs, and deal with climate all at the same time while managing all of the polycrisis issues that the world is facing, unless we have some elbow room. We need elbow room fiscally, we need elbow room in terms of trade policy, we need elbow room in terms of other policy considerations. If we can get that, then we can put our countries on a sustainable path. And remember, if we don't carry along our people at the same time, you have social implosion. You can bring back down debt anytime. Barbados has restructured its debt 4 years ago, 3 years ago, just before COVID came. If we didn't do that, God knows where we would be today. Secondly, having said we can restructure debt anytime, I can't bring back a country after social implosion in under a generation. So that we need to understand that if ever there was a time for us to revisit debt sustainability metrics, it is now. And every dollar of debt is not equivalent. A dollar of debt to build a school does not give me the same rate of return as quickly as a dollar of debt to build a geothermal facility. So that we have to ask the economists, with all due respect, to dig a little deeper and to be a little more granular in terms of its metrics. And if we use these crude proxies, then we end up with crude results, which means people fall in between the cracks.
Excellent. Thank you. Let me next turn to President Kagame. It's as we talk about a long-term time horizon on a focused development strategy, Rwanda stands apart in its region for having achieved some important successes on that trajectory. Could you describe how Rwanda will participate in this program, the Resilience and Sustainability Trust. And perhaps even more significantly, at COP27, you announced a Rwanda-based green climate facility to bring together public and private finance. What's your vision for how this type of instrument, the RST, can actually accelerate public-private finance in Rwanda towards a stronger climate future?
Thank you. Let me thank also Cristalina and the IMF for coming up with this innovative way of doing things. First of all, given the background of COVID that devastated the economies, including the rich countries, so we are in search of what to do to recover, but also to continue anyway doing what was needed even before COVID. So with such a initiative, RST helps, it finds a different approach, adding to what exists already, enabling countries to find resources. All we have to do is first, even we have to prove a point here that with resources, gaps can be filled, economies can grow and people can thrive. But in many cases, as I said, with COVID, when big countries are hit, they have so many ways of accessing finance. But for especially the African continent, developing economies, and we struggle to find ways to get out of this situation that we find ourselves in. So it will help us, the RST will help us to deal with current shocks, either climate or health shocks that we have experienced, or even create resilience in our economic policies and actions to be able to move forward. At the same time, we call upon partnerships between the public and the private, because governments alone cannot really do much on their own. And that's why we encourage the private sector to contribute towards that as well. And we are seeing now that even our partners have contributed. But we are just doing it as Rwanda, but we are thinking about it in the context of how the African continent can also be benefit from this. But I think we need to get started and get going. If we can demonstrate that this works and works well, then I think it will even invite more partners or maybe to step in and make their contributions.
Well, that's an excellent note to conclude your comment on. Obviously, Barbados, Rwanda, a handful of other countries will be first to demonstrate how this can, in fact, leverage public and private resources towards its objectives. And Cristalina, you suggested you have a target for thinking about private sector financial leverage, which ultimately public-private is the instrumentation here that will address the crisis at hand. Mokhtar, you lead an institution designed to achieve that leverage. And you also, through the CCDRs, which you could describe to us, have a collaboration with the IMF so that this, in fact, is an example of good collaboration between the IMF and the World Bank. Could you describe that collaboration and then describe how, building on President Kagame's remarks, countries can use RST resources to unlock even more private sector investment on top of that?
Thank you, Faraj. Christine, it's a pleasure being here. For me, it's very important to talk about it here. I spent a few years of my professional career in this place. And actually, it reminds me of what happened in the 90s when we had those big shocks. And actually, Cristalina, your leadership has been very instrumental in translating all the knowledge that the IMF had in addressing a global public good and massive shock. Actually, the shock that we are having linked to climate change have a huge impact on balance of payment of each of the country. So it's at the core of your mandate. But I think also that I remember at the bank when I was here, at that time we were writing a letter of comfort for the World Bank when the World Bank was preparing budget support. The fund was having an Article 4. You write a letter of comfort to the bank, which realized at that time that it was important to address macroeconomic imbalances. Today we see the reverse. The IMF has really showed that climate change has a massive shock on the economies, use the CCDR of the World Bank as a letter of engagement for the World Bank to be able to disburse money. And I think that's an illustration of what is collaboration and adaptation over time. And I think I would like to commend you really very much, Kristalina, for having done that and show the complementarity of the two institutions. Second point, President Kagame, when we talk about CCDR, people think that it's a diagnostic. Let me give you just some number. Rwanda emission represent 0.0003% of world emissions. Let me repeat that number. 0.003% of world emission. The emission per capita is 1/12 of the world average, 1/5 of the Africa average. In spite of it, the country decided to put huge amount of the scarce resources to address climate change. For me, that is commitment. And if ICE is such a commitment, I think it's important to remind it to the rest of the world, because we talk about it in generic terms, but when people put their money where their mouth is, it has to be highlighted. Yes. And for me, that's what I wanted today by saying that. So a country which emits 0.003% and collect $100 million needs to be commended. But that will not be enough, as you say, to address the global public good. We will need to leverage all this. And the big lesson that we have learned is that public money will not be enough. It will not be enough. Only $2 billion in private money went to adaptation in 2019 and 20. Only $2 billion. This is very small to address floods, to address all the issues that the Prime Minister have mentioned. So we need to mobilize more resources. And I think that this trust fund is extremely important for three reasons. It will create the policies to crowd in more money from the private sector by having the taxonomy, by working on the capital market, by working on the bond market, by creating the conditions in the financial sector to be able to crowd in more. Secondly, it will give some seed money to government to do more PPPs, because those PPPs are the public part in the financing that need to be financed. So government will need the public part in the financing of the PPP. But we are convinced at IFC that we should not be a remake of the past. Part of the production of the economy generated by this adaptation should be located in developing countries. It should not be a situation where in the future all the product will be produced in advanced countries and imported for consumption in developing countries. So I think that what you are calling here, and Kristalina, is the most global conversation. It's about financing the immediate need, contributing to public good, but also to change the paradigm of development of countries to make part of the supply chain. And there is not a greater champion for that than my sister Ngozi here, who has been always pushing for us to create supply chains which are resilient to external shocks. And when through the Africa Free Trade Agreement, we have a solid supply chain, resilience and transformation will happen on the continent.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you. We're now going to come to Ngozi to share your vision of how trade and climate interact and how the RST can be deployed in a manner that helps countries advance really what their primary objective most often is, which is expansion of trade, development of resilient supply chains, ensuring access to both raw material and finished goods in both directions. And I would also note, as Director General of the WTO, you've had a tenure during a time when you've dealt with health crises and climate crises. So your vision of how the RST can accelerate even the WTO's role in bringing together deals and collaborations that address those crises would be extremely welcome. Ngozi.
Well, thank you, Raj, and what a pleasure to be with a wonderful group of people. You know, congratulations to the IMF, to Kristalina, and I'm really excited to see Rwanda and Barbados be at the forefront of demonstrating what this can do, and having Makhtar here to leverage further resources, 10 to 1. From the IFC.
Every grant given gives $10 in climate change investment.
Yeah, so it's an exciting time, and people may be wondering, so what is trade? Why is trade here? What does it have to do? And it's very important Kristalina, it's important you ask that I come and join this, because people do not often think of the partnership or the role of trade in all of this. And trade can be a great facilitator of making things happen, or it can also be an obstruction if trade policies are not well handled. So let me come to that. I want to take off from where Makhtar very nicely landed. Part of the interest in this is I do not believe that you can build resilience if you don't have good trade policies to support that. It's just a fact. You need the innovation to flow from where it is made, whether it's in developing or developed countries, to where it's needed. You need the goods and services to flow. And without trade, this simply cannot happen. Affordability of all of this, you also need to look at trade policy and see what's happening with tariffs. Do we have a regime that makes these goods and services and these innovations affordable and accessible? That is also the role of trade, to move things around at an affordable cost. Now, the very important thing that Makhtar said is, as we looked at what happened, the lessons learned from the pandemic, from the war in Ukraine, we saw that if we are to build resilience in developing countries, in fact, globally, we have to look at what happens with supply chains. And we see that supply chains for certain products are highly concentrated. 80% of vaccines are exported from 10 countries. You look at where solar panels, chips, so many things that are important to building resilience are manufactured. They are concentrated. And I said to myself, for instance, why should Africa import 99% of its vaccines and 95% of its pharmaceuticals? Why can't we deconcentrate and diversify manufacturing and base it in these countries so we have supply chains that are global and diversified and more resilient? And so that is where trade comes in. I'll illustrate that further by saying that, look, you can have all the money and the financing, and I respect all of that. It used to be my business too, and still is to some extent. But I found out in the pandemic what happened. When the COVAX had all the money to import vaccines, what happened? It couldn't, because there were export restrictions that were put in those countries that had the vaccines that stopped the export to those that needed it. And so they were at the back of the queue. Africa, in fact, did not get vaccines till it was too late. So we have to make sure that trade policies are well aligned to change the narrative that we can manufacture in developing countries. We don't have to be exporters of raw materials all the time. We can manufacture and export. We're also centers of innovation. Quite frankly, there's so much innovation happening in many of the developing countries that no one hears about because it's not spread. All that can be done through trade and trade policy. So that's the premise on which I say, do not forget, finance is great, but if you don't have the right measures in place trade-wise, it will stop you. So it's good. I also want people to remember that when the IMF and World Bank were created, the WTO GATT was created at the time, which morphed into the World Trade Organization. And there was a reason, because it was clear that you need all three working together to make things function.
Yes.
Thank you.
Excellent. Hear, hear. I think we all... That's a very important reminder, Ngozi, of what it actually takes to use these and other resources to turn it into both growth and resilience in a climate context. Kristalina, the RST is yours to show things can work.
Yes.
What is your closing thought for
us? Well, my message is the following. 2023 is going to be a difficult year for the world. And the silver lining can only be that we use it to transform our economies, that we accelerate change that will underpin sounder prospects for growth, and that we, the IMF, fully recognize our responsibility to be a force for good. And a force we will be, all of us.
Well, we are at the end of our time together here. Let me thank our extraordinary panel. I come back to Kristalina when you and Uma were introducing the RST. These thoughts around innovation and collaboration come through each and every comment. I want to say a special word about leadership. 2023 will be a tough year, and leaders, all of you in this room and all of you online, are leaders. Leaders use those moments to step up and to lead with more conviction and more strength and more purpose and more determination. And I think you've shown us, Kristalina, what that leadership can look like. It's why we're here to celebrate the RST with you and for you and for your leadership. And I just ask all who have joined this conversation today to take that spirit forward.
Can I have one word before we finish? This is a time for Africa, because we have the US-Africa summit. And I want to finish with the word of an incredible African leader, Nelson Mandela. Impossible until it is done.
It's always impossible until it's done.
Yes.
That's an excellent note to end on. Thank you all very much. And thank you.
That was a somewhat abridged version of a conversation about the IMF's Resilience and Sustainability Trust. You can watch a webcast of the entire event at imf.org. And look for other IMF podcasts on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.